Hi, everybody. I'm William Bloom, and this Compassion Dialogue is with Lynn Sedgemore. Welcome, Lynn.
Hi.
Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Great. Now, listen, before properly introducing you, a few words about this series of dialogues. It's hosted by the Spiritual Companions Trust, which is a UK educational charity. We develop resources for people who are spiritual, but not necessarily religious. In all these dialogues, our purpose is to explore what influences, motivates, and inspires influential activists, authors, and teachers, and hopefully inspire you too. More love, more compassion, more consciousness. Coming up in a few weeks, just before the winter solstice, I'll be talking with Rebecca Beattie, who is a leading activist, teacher, and author in the field of paganism, witchcraft, and druidry. And her books include The Wheel of the Year, Planetary Magic, and Nature Mystics, The Literary Guide to Modern Paganism. She grew up on Dartmoor as a child. Can you imagine growing up on Dartmoor, that extraordinary atmosphere and mythology and culture and the sense of place there? So we'll explore with her what it's like to be a modern pagan in the modern world. And now to properly introduce Lynn. From a working class background, Lynn developed her career to become the principal of Guildford College, Dean of Croydon Business School, and Chief Executive of the National Centre for Excellence in Leadership. Great career. And then left a mainstream career and moved down to Glastonbury, where I live as well, and trained in goddess spirituality. That is quite a move from that very successful mainstream career, which is full of rigour, to Glastonbury, which is, she will share with us, is a little bit bonkers sometimes. And she has some really interesting insights into how goddess and female culture can be integrated into hardcore leadership. And this is important to me and my heart and to your hearts as well. She is a force for good. So, Lynn, for all of that, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome. Welcome. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Lynn, tell us a little bit about your working class childhood.
Okay. I'm really proud of being working class. I wear it as a badge of pride and honour. I was born the eldest, not the firstborn, but the eldest living child of my dad was a South Walian miner who moved to the Midlands. My mum was a factory worker, and I've got a brother and a sister who are 7 and 14 years younger than me. And I had a lovely childhood. We were poor. I didn't know how poor we were till I went to grammar school when I was 11. But the kind of upbringing I had, my parents were salt of the earth. My dad was a real family man. Education was the way out. So they encouraged all three of us to really study, to work hard. And they wanted us to have a better life than theirs. My dad ended up again as a factory worker. So they wanted their children to have a better life. And they were really, really supportive and encouraging. My mum had had 5 miscarriages and they had a firstborn child that died at 8 months. So they were devoted parents when they finally had 3 healthy children.
Was he mining, working in the mines when you were a child, or he'd left?
Yes, absolutely. He went to Stoke in the 50s. I'm from Stoke, and we were on a mining estate. Okay. So it was full of families. We were the foreigners in Stoke, actually, inverted commas, that's what they called us, because we were from Scotland, Newcastle on Tyne, Wales, you know, different parts of the country, and we didn't speak Stoke. I speak Stoke.
So here's a question. What kind of state was he in when he came home from working in the mines?
My dad, well, he'd have black face, you know, he'd have to have a shower. They always had like little, always looked like they had eyeliner on because they could never quite get the soot out of there. So, yeah, so he would come home. But my dad loved the mine. He was a deputy. It was his place. He talked about the camaraderie. He loved it. And he was somebody down the mine. He was, you know, he was a deputy. And he had to come out of the mines because of ill health. And he was never the same after that. Never the same.
Was ill health due to the coal dust?
Yes, the lungs, emphysema because of the dust. But if you talk to most miners, if they found a way of enjoying it, the camaraderie, your life depended on someone else. I've got cousins who are miners. I actually, my first husband, he was a upper middle class lad working down the mine. So basically, I kind of married a miner, but made him come out the pit. Like, I've really lived with a miner, and you're playing at being a miner, bless him. So he did come out.
What was it like for you segueing into a grammar school then? Because that would have been quite a jump, wouldn't it, to have done the 11 plus? And
I loved it. Couldn't wait to go. I deliberately chose not to go to the posh grammar school. I deliberately went to Clayton Hall Grammar School, which was, you couldn't pay to go there. You had to pass your 11 plus. I was quite clear that I didn't go to Oxford and Cambridge for the same reason, is I didn't want to go into an environment where I was looked down on. So basically I went to Clayton Hall Grammar School for girls, and I loved it. I loved it. The only really thing that I found out there was how poor we were and what we didn't have, because there were a lot of girls that were a lot wealthier than us. Yeah.
That's a very poignant thing to hear, that some of your life decisions were based on not wanting to be looked down on. And that's something you were conscious of from the age of 10, 11.
I was conscious of it. Probably, no, conscious of it, yeah, at least 10, 11, probably earlier than that. My mum, our Christmas presents were all bought by Green Shield stamps. Mm-hmm. That my mum saved. Our clothes were all bought by the provvy checks. So there was a shame when you went into a shop and you brought out your provvy check. You were immediately looked down on. I came from Crackley Estate. If you said you were from Crackley, you were either thick, common, or a thief. People literally, you know, you wouldn't put the word Crackley in.
Spell it out for me, Lynn. When what were people actually doing in the way you could say, oh, they're looking down on me? What was
okay.
their behaviour?
So when I had a boyfriend from Chesterton, and he introduced me to his family, and you said you lived on Crackley, you could see them frown, and then immediately say, you know, don't really want her. There were issues in my first marriage around that we got over. It's that people, it's a stereotypical view that they have of you that's not based on knowing you. It's based on, Crackley, therefore you must be a thief or common or whatever. And I've had that all my life. And that's why I'm so committed to diversity and fighting oppression. And really, and I get quite emotional about this, my whole life is devoted to supporting and helping other people to reach their full potential. Because I've been able to reach mine, but not all my friends could. And I've seen people really, really squashed and harmed and hurt by those stereotypical, nasty perceptions of you as a human being, you know, and not even bothering to get to know you.
I know. Well, snobbery is an awful form of aggression.
Absolutely. And everybody who's oppressed experiences that.
Yeah, no, it's awful.
But my primary oppression, obviously I've got gender oppression, but is class. And it hurts. I can feel myself going red and hot now. You know, it's still in my body. It's still something that's very, very real experience. Yeah.
Well, it's not just real for you. It's a reality of life that sits deep under, I may go off on one now, which I don't want to, sits deep under racism and sexism and anti-Semitism and all that. There's class stuff going on that
Absolutely.
is very subtle, and most of the people who play it out are unconscious of the fact they're playing it out. But there's a form of aggression, passive aggression, that's continually mini traumatizing folk, putting them down. Anyway, listen, we might go off on a political one right now, which I don't want to do. So you went to grammar school. And inside your experience of grammar school, I think if I read your history right, there was something also happening to you in terms of a relationship with God, Christ, spirituality.
I've always been religious. I'm not religious now. I'm spiritual, I hope. But I only knew when you're a kid on Crackley, you only know about Christianity. I didn't know other things. So I was always looking for God from being six. I can remember asking, where's God? Where do I find God? I went to, we used to be sent to Sunday school. We brought up Methodist, but then I took myself to the Salvation Army when I was nine, and I was in that until I was 15. I became a Mormon when I was 17. I used to always ask the Jehovah's Witnesses in. So I was always wanting conversations about God and understanding. Now I would call it true reality. But then it was phased through a patriarchal kind of...
Was this inquiry and looking for truth, was that purely going on in your mind brain, or was it a kind of heartfelt experience of something other that was touching you?
Right. As long as I can remember, but the first really strong one was when I was about 14 or 15. So I used to have light experiences. I used to experience just being filled with light. Well, I still do, filled with light. So the reason I became a Mormon, I can laugh about it now, but it was really real at the time, is I'm reading the Book of Mormon, because I used to read the Bible. I used to read all the scriptures. I'm reading the Book of Mormon and I have one of these light experiences. So of course I think, oh, this must be the truth. And then I read about Joseph Smith and it's all pictures of him receiving light. So that's why I became a Mormon.
Right.
So I'm a mystic really. So I was having these experiences, but nobody understood them and there was nobody to really talk to about them.
All right. So you have to, for me and for the kind of folk I know listening to us, could you just, I don't want to be intrusive, but I'd love to hear you describe the nature of the light, what you call the light experience, the feelings of it, the phenomena, if any. What was going on for you?
I do this in my latest book as well, The Presence Activism. What it is, it was almost, it happened to me. It wasn't something I was trying to make happen. So I would be... It used to happen to me a lot in church, you see, less in nature than it does now. So if I was in church or a sacred space, particularly if it had incense or bells, then it was as if something's activated in me that actually is the most beautiful sense of being filled with light and knowing that everything in the universe is love. Absolutely everything is made up of love. The silence, the peacefulness, the inner tranquility that comes with that. And I go like this. It's like, because I'm a very active kind of busy person, it's a complete gentle, slowing peacefulness of just being. I have words for it now, but I didn't then. And it's just beautiful. And
how old were you when it first happened, do you remember?
I think I was about 7 or 8.
Yeah.
And I'd say to my mom, oh, do you get that? And she didn't, nobody knew what I was talking about.
How long did those experiences last for? A few seconds or minutes? And did they have a halo effect?
I wouldn't say that. It was just more how I felt. I mean, and there have been times when people have said I was shining. They could see that something had happened. My dad saw it once. My dad was like, what's happened to you? So there was a light around me around that.
Yeah.
But I didn't have words. But I knew it was the most important thing in my life, that nothing else mattered like that did.
I should have communicated better. When I said halo effect, I meant that there was a kind of echo that kind of lasted inside you.
Oh, absolutely. It's visceral. I mean, I can recall them now, you know, and they stay in the body. They're realer than anything else. So when people say, oh, it's rubbish what you're talking, or don't do that, it's just like, you can't take this away from me because I know it. It's realer than daily life to me. That's the only way I can describe it. It was more real than anything that was going on the surface.
If we were in a room right now, if everybody who was listening to us was live, I'd say, give us a wave of hands, everybody who's had a similar experience. You know, I can see a few hands waving.
Yeah,
it's interesting, isn't it? Because the experience is universal,
absolutely,
but the interpretation is cultural,
absolutely.
So listen, so you're going through grammar school with this. Your heart was already opened, right?
Yeah,
and you were aware of this other dimension, and were you a naughty teenager as well?
I was
quite feisty.
Right. Okay. I made sure that I was always in the top three of the A stream. So I always came in the top because I was very, very bright academically. So I was always in the top three so that I could be rebellious. I'd say I was rebellious. I was always breaking the rules, but not sufficiently that I would ever get expelled. So yeah, I got caught smoking behind the woodshed. I used to roll my skirts up with an elastic band. And I challenged the teachers. I was always questioning. And if they ever made a mistake, I would point it out. But my English teacher was my savior. She used to say, Lynn Sedgemoor, I spend my life defending you in the classroom. Why can't you be with the other teachers like you are with me? And I went on to read English at university because of her. And I'm saying, because they're not like you, miss. Yeah, there. And I think I also felt a bit of a looking down on the crackly kids, and I wasn't having it.
Yeah, so there was that snobbery again. So you only did English at uni?
Yeah, English and American literature.
Okay, so the great novels, which were the ones that blew you apart, blew you out? What novels would stand out as?
Well, I went to Canterbury so I could read 21st century literature.
Yeah.
So discovering Virginia Woolf, all of those, Ashley Zola, the realists, it was the 19th century realist for me, and the American, Scarlet Letter. So there were novels in there. I loved Hardy as well. There were novels in there that were about working class people, that were about lives that I could relate to. Which I really, really enjoyed. And I did Sartre. So actually, I adored Sartre.
Did you?
Existentialism. Absolutely. Oh,
did you dress appropriately for reading Sartre? Were you one of those ladies in black and looking slightly bohemian and mysterious?
No, black's too boring for me. No. Okay. No.
How about John Steinbeck?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I read him in the sixth form, really, but I didn't. I tell you who I loved. It's really Faulkner and Conrad. They were the two that I absolutely adored.
Quite blokey.
I know. But I did. And I loved J.D. Salinger as well. But I was reading Virginia Woolf, and I did, you know, Kent, when I went in 1974, Kent was a hotbed of feminism and women's studies. So we were reading all the women's writers and reclaiming them as well, yeah.
So were you reading anything spiritual, religious at the same time? What was happening at uni? Were you still having light experiences, or were they kind of mellowed out for a while?
Well, I had a baby, which took a lot of my time.
Yeah.
And actually what had happened to me, I was so disillusioned with Mormonism and the hypocrisy of Christianity that I decided I wasn't doing religion anymore, that I was going to be political. Yeah, that actually I would do good in the world in a different way. So, and then I got pregnant accidentally, very working class thing. But I was engaged, so we got married and I took a year out. And so I became a very ardent second wave feminist. That had started for me at about 17. And so while at university, I was helping to set up nurseries. I was, you know, woman's right to choose, the women's liberation's demands. So I was probably 90% of my time being a second wave feminist and a mother, and the rest of my time studying for my degree.
So were the white light experiences temporarily put on hold, or were they integrating into that? And your experience of birth, and were they threaded into your experience of birth and that kind of thing?
What I experienced, I've only given birth once. I've got one daughter. I've got two stepdaughters. I knew I'd looked at Buddhism by then. I knew what unconditional love was when I became a mother. I was just 20. I was completely, completely in raptures of being a mother. It was really hard because I was young and I was doing a degree, but Jeff's parents helped us financially, and he was a brilliant father and dad. So all that love went into my daughter. I'm a grandmother. It's a spiritual experience for me, being with children, in the sense of that giving that total unconditional love. It's love in action for me. It's spirituality.
Let me put the jigsaw together. It's a spiritual experience, partly because your sense of the cosmos, the universe, is it's filled with love.
Yeah.
And that then expresses in your love as a mother.
Yeah. And as an activist. So for me, love is service. Service is love.
Love in action.
Yeah. I'm a karma yogi, if you like. I'm a bhakti yoga and a karma yogi. Yeah, mostly.
Tell the listeners the difference between the two.
Okay, bhakti yoga is heartfelt yoga. So yes, put me in a chant, particularly with Hindu bhajans, and I'm gone within 2 minutes. You know, that total opening and expansiveness. I listen to all sorts of Hindu songs and chants. Karma yogi is really from the Bhagavad Gita, which is more being love in action. So you express it through service and right action and duty. And then jhana yoga is more through the mind and the intellect. So I've got some of that, but I don't get the same kind of satisfaction that I know other people do spiritually through the mind. Yeah.
Oh, here we're putting the jigsaw together of you, getting a sense of you. So you then develop a career as an educator in FE.
Yeah, I fell into that. So what happened when I finished university, I said to Jeff, I want to go back home to Stoke. It's really hard. I've got no family here. So he got a job in Stoke. So we went back to Stoke for 4 years, and I was a full-time feminist activist. I worked in a community centre off and on, and I was trying to run a bookshop, but it was all about being an activist and being a mum. And then Jeff got a job in London, and I said, yeah, I'll come to London. And I applied for one job because the mortgage was so high, because that we were moving from Stoke to London. And I said, I'll apply for a job, and I got it, and that was in FE, and I thought it was a community worker.
What was the job?
It was a lecturer one in life and social skills on a YTS youth training opportunity scheme in Croydon College.
All right, listen, I have to tell you, I also was an L1 in life and social skills at Southwark College, right?
Of an age, isn't it? Yes.
It's an incredible grounding place to be of service in a way that lots of people don't know about.
I know. Well, I'd worked part-time in the Stoke FE College. I'd fallen into that as well. So, because I always did part-time work and I liked it. I used to teach sex education, maths to the towpath lads off the towpath schemes. That was fun. And then applied for that one job and got it. And honestly, the college was 10 minutes away from the house that we'd already decided to buy. So it all fell in. And so I was going to be a feminist publisher. I was really active in publishing feminist stories and poems and things. But I loved the job so much. And to be honest, working in FE in those days, having a full-time job was like a part-time job. Couldn't believe it. And you could do a million other things as well. So I thought I'd discovered heaven, and I loved it. I really liked it. And I've stayed in FE.
I did too. And I'm just so sorry we're going to move on from teaching sex education to lads on the towpath, because that just sounds extraordinary. But you worked your way up inside the college, L1, L2, senior lecturer, head of department.
Yeah, the whole works. I was never a PL. I was everything else. Okay. L1, L2, SL, head of department 4, head of department 5, head of department 6, vice principal, principal.
Okay, so head of department, which part of the college were you head of department of?
Okay, well, I went to Hackney. I went from Croydon to Hackney, and I was a curriculum cross-college head of department for equality, curriculum, student services. There were about 5 other things as well. So it was one of those, it was a positive action post for a woman, because there were no women heads of department, and it was cross-college on 14 sites in a 22-mile radius. It was the hardest job I've ever done. So I did that, and then I came back to Croydon. I only lasted 18 months at Hackney and Tower Hamlets. Didn't fit me culturally. Went back to Croydon, and I was head of the Marketing Research and Development Unit, then Dean of Croydon Business School, then Vice Principal Higher Education, then Vice Principal Academic, and then Principal of Guildford College.
All right, so here's question I really, really want to ask you, and in a sense it's almost like coach me. How did a woman as vital and bubbly and committed as you manage to sit through so many meetings, hours of meetings every day as a principal? How did you do that?
Well, two things, right? One, I got myself in charge very quickly of things, right? So that I would do bids, and then I would get promoted in to run the bid. So I was used to being in charge, literally, from being an L2 and an SL. So by the time I'm the principal, well, I make meetings fun. I used to say to people, I'm not coming to boring meetings. I'm not coming to any effective meetings. And it's up to us to make them interesting and fun. When I was dean of the business school, I put fun in the values, and half the school loved it. And the bankers and the accountants went ballistic. Like, who's this squit of a woman? I used to love being called a squit of a woman. What, it was not a slip of a woman.
Slip, okay.
And I used to go, you mean that as an insult? And, you know, I'm usually overweight. So to be the slip of anything, thank you very much, which is very disarming for people. So I would make them interesting. And if they're not interesting, I would say, well, if we're not going to do anything much, I'm off. I've got away with things that most people wouldn't, because I always delivered. I always delivered over and above. It's what I did at school, and it's what I've done throughout my career. High performance, overachieving, and you can get away with all sorts of things.
Okay, so let me just unravel this just a little bit, because any of us listening here who've been involved in any kind of organization which has administrative processes knows that there are meetings where different perspectives come into the room.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And those different perspectives need to be heard. And you as principal would have been chairing, holding the space of the meeting. And what I'm hearing is that you kind of cut across people who were boring.
No, I was talking earlier. No, if I'm chairing a meeting, you've got to be really inclusive and allow all those things. But earlier in my career, you'd go to tedious meetings. When I was dean of the business school, I used to send my deputy to the dean's meetings. I was really arrogant as well. I'd send my deputy, and they'd go, who do you think you are? I go, somebody who's doing strategy, and they're all about tactics and operational. So I'm sending my deputy because I don't do that stuff. That's what my deputy does because it's operational. And actually, you should all be strategic, but you're all operational. But I mean, it backfired on me. They would be aggressive back to me and all that kind of stuff. But I can live with that.
All right. So reading some of the biographical stuff on you in advance of this, I read that one of your processes was coming to a recognition of what you've just named, that arrogance.
Yeah,
absolutely. And needing to go through a internally therapeutic process of working through it.
Yeah, I'm an 8 on the Enneagram. So if anybody knows the 8 on the Enneagram, we're always right. We usually are, actually, but we think we're right.
You would say that, wouldn't you?
Of course I would. I'm an 8. But even when we're wrong, we think we're right. So we have to learn to be much more inclusive, much more allowing. So we are forces of energy that get things done.
So how do you balance that with this other experience you've been having all the way through your life of the universe is made of love and you are an agent of love? Was it a kind of bipolary thing going on in you or what?
No. This is the really big exploration I needed to do. Yeah. Is love just fluffy and sweet and nice and lets people just get away with anything? Yeah. What is the nature of unconditional love? Yeah. And I've been on trainings or been with people that unconditional love to me means they've checked out, really. And it's like anything goes. So I'm not saying I'm right, but I had to work that out for me. And I think there's a place for tough love. And there's a place for something that says boundaries matter, commitments matter, joint coming together to co-create something. And finding a way that we honor different styles and different ways of doing it matter. And that's been a lifelong exploration for me to learn that the completion of the task isn't always everything. Yeah. Sometimes it is, and sometimes you can relax things and go slower. And that processes, but I was a task-centered person who then had to learn that processes are equally as important, but I still want to get the task done if it needs to be done, yeah?
Okay, so that's a kind of, you've kind of written a get-out-of-jail card.
Have I?
Yeah, which is great.
Oh, right, because it feels real to me.
Yeah. But what I'm interested in, because these conversations are about people's inner lives and inner processes and developmental processes, you named very clearly arrogance, right?
Oh, yeah.
which mixed with your huge vitality would make you quite a steamroller in
absolutely.
So, but having to slow that down and deconstruct it in the middle of a world which requires quite dynamic feminism and quite dynamic breaking down of class barriers.
Yeah.
You know, as an agent of change, as an agent of goodwill, the arrogance is maybe not arrogance, but wonderful and good and confident.
Kind of yes and no, because I think we learn as I have learned as I've gone deeper to know when I'm in a toxic kind of reactivity thing that isn't really very healthy for me or anybody else, and when I might be standing so when I'm doing this rather than this, yeah, and I've had to learn to do this. It's like I'm setting a boundary here. I'm not going to put up with that, you know. Whereas as a second wave feminist, we had to fight, you know, and the things that would get said to us. I used to be on Reclaim the Night, and they'd try and run us down in the streets. And yes, I would get aggressive. I mean, I've nearly got arrested. I've been put in vans and by the police and managed to talk my way out of it. because I would get angry when I'm picketing a nightclub and or on an anti-Nazi league and or a pro-choice march, and there's a huge aggression. It's I've had to learn to manage a spontaneous kind of that comes up for me. And what the Enneagram did for me, this is the biggest thing. It showed me why people were scared of me. Yeah. Because I'm thinking, I'm just a teddy bear, really. You know, if I'm really having a go at you, actually, it's because I love you and because I care and because I'm engaged. And then gradually I had to learn that actually you're pulverizing people. Yeah. And truth can be unkind and not being kind enough. I've always wanted to be kinder. So in that sense, the Enneagram was the most amazing tool for me to realize, oh, that's why I'm scary. I'm so intense and I'm so passionate. I think I'm giving you my truth, which I am, but actually you feeling headbutted by me. Yeah. That level of intensity and all of that. So, yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting for me this moment is that I find myself wanting to support that. A very useful phrase I learned a while ago was creative aggression. You know, there's aggression which is destructive and there's aggression which is creative. And in liberation movements, and feminism is a liberation movement, and working against classism is also a liberation movement. It requires force. And there are agents, human beings are required to be those agents of courage and bravery and pushiness. So I'm actually possibly more forgiving of your aggression than you are.
Yeah, I think I would want passionate creative assertion. And I was an assertiveness trainer. Remember when we all did assertiveness training? Yeah. And I deliberately trained as an assertiveness trainer to help me with that, to understand the difference. Because even if a woman's assertive, she can be seen as aggressive. So if you an eight woman and you can be aggressive, then it feels a double whammy. So yeah, I hear what you're saying and I appreciate it. And I can be quite emotional about this. It's been a bane in my life to feel that I can be that fierce with people. So it's still something that I don't want to be fierce other than in a compassionate, assertive way.
My heart is touched by what you say. And at the same time, you know, I found myself supporting activists. And one of the things I've said quite often, listen, if you stir it up, people are going to throw shit at you. Right? You put your head above the parapets.
Sure. And I don't mind that. I love stirring it up. And I've literally had shit posted through my letterbox in a Christmas card. I thought it was Christmas cake and it wasn't. They very kindly wrapped it up in cling film, which was very sweet of them. It was my daughter registered what it was. So I have literally had shit posted in my letterbox. It was horrendous. I've never been so upset in my life. But yeah, so I don't mind that. And I don't mind being fierce. It's just when I think I've just got a new insight what it is. It's when I've not been fully composed and coming from the light and the love, and I've lost touch with that, I think.
Yeah, but that's such a tough ask, you know, to be at the front of a march dealing with aggression and having to stay centered. That is a tough ask.
I would hope I can do it now. I think I did it the last feminist march I was on, but I wasn't doing it when I was 18 and 19 and 20.
But the problem though is when you're fronting off forces that are essentially bullying.
Oh, yeah.
And therefore abusive.
Yeah.
Abuse needs more than a clear boundary. It needs something forceful sometimes, because I could never quite go with the pacifist yielding to it, though I celebrate those who can.
And we've all got different, the Enneagram framework gives 9 different types. You know, there are different ways of looking at it. So we all bring something different, don't we? So I'm quite happy to be a warrior. I've enjoyed being a warrior, but I'm really practicing much more of my 9 wing now, which is peacemaker.
Yeah. Okay. So there's this very successful career in mainstream world, FE, leadership. And then you move into your 50s, 60s, some kind of retirement is happening. And you and your bloke choose to come down to Glastonbury, which is, I mean, I live here, so I know how bonkers it is, and that's one of the things I love about it. But what was it like? Because you also did some trainings here as well, right? So I'm wondering what it was like for you to come out of, in mainstream education, colleges, qualifications maintain their status by virtue of the fact there's real integrity around the assessment process and the even playing field, and the fact that wherever you do it in the country, it's the same, and everybody, blah, 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 blah. You come to Glastonbury and you meet Glasto bonkers education.
Yeah, well, what you have, right, remember, I've been coming to Glastonbury since 1989, so it wasn't like I just moved to this new place. I've been coming to Glastonbury for 1989, since 1989. I did my National Federation of Spiritual Healers training here. I did rebirthing training here. So I managed to come every year. And I always loved it and knew that I would come here one day. It's my spiritual home. It's my sacred vortex. You know, the Chalice Well is my favorite place on the planet. And I used to go to Findhorn in the 90s as well, but Glastonbury was it for me. So I kind of knew what I was coming to, but it's not the same as living here. Yeah. And being engaged from the inside out, as it were.
Did you go temporarily mad after you moved here? Because a lot of people, when they get caught in the actual vortex of living here, there's about a year of everything is so stimulated that they temporarily lose it.
No, I didn't. What happened to me is I had a house fire. My husband nearly died. My mum had a stroke. Every year from when we came here, there was some major, major traumatic life issue. That was how Glastonbury tested us. And I stayed working for 5 years while I sort of came into Glastonbury gradually. And to be honest, my first dip into it, working with, I won't name them, but working with a group of people, after 6 months, I went, I'm not doing it. I'm staying another year in my job. I'm not doing it. This is bonkers. And John, my husband, he immersed himself. He's a 9 on the Enneagram. He's really laid back. He's really tolerant and accepting, you know, he's unconditional love on legs, really. So he's managed it, although he struggled with a recent project he's just done. So basically, I kind of put myself in slowly. And then because I'm an interfaith minister and I've explored all different faiths and traditions and feel that I belong everywhere, actually, which is interesting, I then decided I had worked with Goddess Spirituality. We haven't mentioned that, but I did in the 70s. I had this amazing experience of the rolling hills and being goddess in the land on a women's writing course in Barlaston. But then I decided to ensconce myself in Goddess Spirituality, not to do any mainstream work other than coaching and bits and pieces, not to be on any boards, and to throw myself into Goddess Spirituality, which is what I did. 5 years priestess training. I'm a priestess healer, priestess of Avalon. And then they learned about my other skills, so they invited me to help out in processes and things like that. And that wasn't easy. Wasn't easy because my experience, I don't want to criticize anybody, but there is an experience for me of alternatives and anarchists, and this is right across Glastonbury, who are allergic to any kind of processes and don't want them, and it's all the patriarchy or it's the horrible capitalists, but actually can at their worst be more exploitative of people than any public sector organization would ever be, because it has safeguards to protect people. So I had that dialogue with several groups, and some of them listened to me and some of them thought I was a capitalist, whatever. So basically, yeah, all those were going on. And then I ended up chairing the town deal, which is like the most nightmare bureaucratic government funding funneled through a local authority with 11 Glastonbury projects. And I'm loving it. On really bad days, I'm out of here, but I don't. And I'm loving it. And I think actually there's very few people who could chair this because it needs somebody like me who can traverse all those worlds and work with it.
So for people who don't know, the town deal was a £25 million grant from central government to Glastonbury for regeneration. And I think that's where you and I probably first met, actually, was on one of the projects. So here you are now, November 2023, with this extraordinary wealth of experience, living in this extraordinary place.
Ooh,
touring my picture behind me. What's your take on the world in general at the moment? I see your eyes rolling.
Well, I don't get overwhelmed very often, but at the moment, even I'm struggling with sleeping sometimes at night, with just how much is going on, what's happening in the Middle East, climate. As you know, I've just written a book around climate anxiety.
It comes out in the spring, doesn't it?
Yes, although I've got copies, actually. I've got copies.
How come you've got copies and it's coming out in the spring?
Because I'm a magician. I must bring you one round.
Yeah, but can people buy it from you?
Yes, they can.
So if they go to lynnsagemore.com, they can get it. lynnsagemore.co.uk. I'll put it in the...
The Glastonbury Goddess Shop has got them. Okay. Gareth Hollow Hills has got them.
And this one online?
Goddess Shop does them online. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's another story, but I've got them. They've let me sell them in Glastonbury.
Great.
Yeah. What was the question? I forgot it now.
What do you make of the state of the world? And what did you have some advice for other activists?
Well, I've written my book on presence activism because I genuinely believe whatever the question, the situation, the complexity, presence is the answer. What I have learned, I'm using the term presence to get back in touch with that feeling, that experience that I was describing, rather than give it a label of a god or a goddess or whatever. I think being able to be and to keep remembering that we are all love, that the whole universe is benign, and if we can be from that place ourselves, then hopefully it can ripple out. I also think acting is important and standing up to abuse at the moment. Our local government, I was also a lobbyist for 7 years after, before I retired. So I used to watch all the political stuff that was going on. It just fills me with despair at the moment. I don't really feel despair, but if I did, it's just so horrific. I just think we have to act locally. Personally, the choice I've made is that I am going to do right action in whatever shape or form I can, in the best way that I can, and make the differences that I can in my local community. And if I can work on a bigger sphere, then I will. But so my advice to people is to know what it is your vocation here now in the mess and the complexity and all the rest of it, and see the beauty and the joy amidst all of that, and be the best you can be and do the best right action that's possible for you. And it'll be different for all of us.
So let's say one of our listeners is a very quiet person, slightly with a mystical bent, who is not very sociable.
Yeah.
What would you advise them to do?
I would advise them to do whatever their service is. It may be that they pray. I genuinely believe there's a place for contemplatives in the world who pray. I wanted to be a nun for years. They would never have me, and I would never have made a good nun. But I had the nun urge, which is that inner contemplative, which is to be of service in whatever way you can. And that may be offering prayers, lighting candles, doing something that's not extrovert or whatever, going and helping out in your food bank. You don't have to talk to anybody. You can just label soup. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? It's just find what's your right action, because we can do it. And that's what I love about Glastonbury. We all talk about bonkers Glastonbury, but there's a caring, there's, you know, Love Glastonbury, which is an organization that feeds people. You know, there's so much going on in Glastonbury about caring for other people. It's beautiful. Yeah.
And for those folk who have energy to be a bit more social and out there, where would you, what might you suggest for them?
Well, in my book, do a bit of a plug again.
You've got elevator pitch. You've got a couple of minutes to tell people what
banks,
to do.
I'm a rubbish marketer. From food banks to, you know, chairing the town deal, which is what I'm doing. But, you know, not everybody can chair a town deal, but you can set up something in your community or join something that's already there in the community that's helping to feed anything from helping to feed people or to, you know, find presents, donate to people, everything. I mean, people are actually not able to afford to eat. You know, Stoke at the moment is really, really in a terrible state as well, but people are all over the world, but there's so huge levels of deprivation there. And just find something that you can make contribute. And it also nourishes your soul, because I think service, I don't have a problem when people say, well, service is sometimes you're getting something back from it. Good, because we need to be in a virtuous cycle of giving and receiving in a way that sustains you and you can keep doing it.
I like the idea of you having wanted to be a nun. You'd be a formidable nun, which you can imagine.
They wouldn't have me.
No, I'm serious.
What they used to say to me is, I've got the vote. Somebody said, I don't do Jesus either. So that was a bit of but I could have been a Buddhist nun, but that didn't work either. But the Christian nun is like, I don't really do Jesus. I just do light, really. But basically, it was, well, Lynn, you've kind of got a vocation, a mystical vocation, but you haven't got the temperament. Well, I did. I used to spend for years. I was in monasteries and convents. I'm an oblate of Dowie Abbey. Yeah, I do like the monastic life holds an attraction for me.
All right. So let's, for our last few minutes, as we bring this conversation towards a close, let's shift tempo.
Okay.
And the tempo is, if this is not too intrusive, if you're okay talking about it,
yeah.
What's your practice, daily practice now? What takes you into that mellow, connected to love space?
Yeah. Sitting, gazing, being, literally walking.
What kind of sitting? What kind of gazing?
Right. Well, I'm sitting upright. As I am now. It's like a sort of, I'm a Ridwan student. I'm in the Diamond Heart. I've been in that community for 20 years. Feet on the floor, hands on my knees, what we would call Samadhi meditation. Feel the calf, the stomach. Be aware of it if you need to. Breathing. So it's going really presencing, centering, getting there, and then gradually dropping into just non-doing, wu-wei, if you like, and sitting, and then just allowing whatever arises. Not wanting a particular state. That took me years, that one. Not wanting a particular state, not feeling I should have a particular state, just absolutely being with what's there. Sometimes I actually like sitting in temple-y type spaces. I always have done. But walking on the land or sitting in the land, that's why I went to Goddess Spirituality, the embodiment of the land. I needed to kind of really go into a community that helped me to do that. So for me, that's my primary practice, sensing and presencing. If I can't get there, if I'm which isn't that often nowadays, but it used to be, I can't get there. Then chanting, for me, chanting, particularly Hindu bhajans, chanting just totally brings, I don't know, it's just, I'm doing it, it's just like it's a bring me down. Because I, and the practice, the other practice I have is noticing how much I'm in and how much I'm out. 80, 20, 60, 40, 90% out there, yeah. Because as an 8 on the Enneagram, it's all about being out there. So I've had to learn to really notice in this presence in then when I would move through the day, constantly practicing the presence and noticing how much is in, how much is out, where is my attention, where is my beingness, where is my doingness. I love Brother Lawrence's practicing the presence of God. That's had an immense effect on me. So there's a bit of, I'm do quite a bit of Brother Lawrence, really, in the kitchen, wherever you are. Yeah.
Lovely. Thank you. What would you say is your spiritual learning curve coming up for you? Do you have a sense of that, where your developmental process needs to go? It's always helpful for us to hear about someone else's because it kind of has echoes for what we might be doing too.
It's for me at the moment, it's practical creativity, right? So I can be in my head and I can be in the doing. I've just started making rosaries, prayer beads, rosaries. I made 100 within the first 3 months. So I'm trying to slow it down. So it's being really mindful and prayerful while doing. I've just found a new practice actually of creating these rosaries and putting prayers into every bead, putting them in the chalice well waters. So in that sense, it's a different kind of doing. I would say it's a more contemplative doing and being out of the world more. Yeah.
Where do you get the beads?
Where do I get the beads?
Yeah.
All over. I got them from America. I was going to go on a trip to Czechoslovakia, the Czech beads. I love the glass, Czech glass beads. Get them all where you should see my living room. It's full of beads. I'm going to have to find a new place to put them. Yeah. But I think that's my edge. And an edge for me that I've had all my life is to be kinder. People say I am kind. I know I'm generous, but it's a big emotional thing for me. I still don't feel I'm truly naturally kind. So I'm always working on that.
Yeah, I think you're being a bit tough on yourself because I think you're a force for good and that in itself is kind. And I think, you know what you're saying, people don't understand tough love. That's just love which is honest. And people need honesty. So I reckon you're kind.
Maybe. And people... I just want to say one thing before we finish it. Glastonbury has so welcomed me. Glastonbury ejects some people. It doesn't work. Glastonbury, it's taken me in. It sees me, it accepts me, it's found service for me. I just feel there's a sacred right action for Glastonbury for me. It's my place. I absolutely adore it.
Well, there's a little commercial for Glastonbury, people. Come visit. Well, for many of us is the most crucial sacred site in Europe, actually. But may not be your place. Yeah.
You
spend a few days here toddling around and getting a sense of it all. Lynn, what an extraordinary, wonderful, vibrant conversation. Extraordinary, wonderful, lovely, deep.
Thank you.
Just full of energy and encouragement and enthusiasm. Just want to thank you very much. I hope it was good for you too.
It was lovely, yeah. And you've got me to be emotional. Well, you haven't got me, but yeah. No, thank you. It felt sensitive, but deep, and challenging, and kind, and gentle, yeah, but probing.
Well, that's compassion dialogues. That's what we're trying to do. So listen, I'm going to This is me saying big thank you. And then we're going to take you off spotlight, put everybody into the picture, and then everybody who's here will take the mute all. You can unmute yourselves now, everybody. Okay. There we go. Everybody, give this beautiful soul a wave and any noise of gratitude you want to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.